So, hey, everybody, welcome back to SaaS Marketing Mastery. I am here with the show's normal host, Mike Harris. Mike, thank you so much for taking some time to have both of us on.
Yeah, you're welcome, Miles. I appreciate it.
So I'm super excited about this show. I know you know the software and marketing world really well, and you're someone I've learned from over the last couple of years. So I appreciate the chance to guest interview you. But I thought for a first question, you're obviously going to be the host of this new podcast. It's kind of a logical conclusion to have you explain, you know, who is Mike Harris in your own words?
Mike Harris is a senior executive marketer. I've worked as a CMO for tech companies for the last 25 years. I grew up in East Tennessee. I know a lot of Tennessee jokes, and I love my SaaS and tech clients quite a bit. We have a good time together and we get a lot done.
And some of your background is pretty varied, right? I mean, you've worked for some of the really large tech companies all the way down to some more modern startups in the last decade. So what's that range of who you've actually worked with, even within the broad software category?
Yeah, sure. I started my career in Atlanta with a predecessor of PricewaterhouseCoopers, the large accounting consulting firm, and I did consulting for 2 years, and then joined Philips, the large conglomerate out of the Netherlands. And over a period of time, I wound up running a $100 million division of that company, which was a turnaround, and it got a little bit of publicity because it turned out well. And then I was recruited to come to California to work for a $500 million data storage company. And that was back when they were hiring anybody that could spell marketing. So they yanked me out of the consumer electronics world and put me in data storage. And that began my career in technology. So I worked in data storage and then data networking and enterprise software. And then when everything started moving to the cloud, I also started working in SaaS.
So you actually have a lot of experience in both B2C and B2B.
Yes, that is correct.
Which is a little bit rare because most of the time the word SaaS nowadays, correct me if I'm wrong, sort of has come to mean B2B SaaS.
That is correct, yes.
So with this podcast, I know SaaS Marketing Mastery is the name you picked. I'd love for you to explain to me, what's your vision for the show? Who are you going to be bringing on? What topics are going to be covered?
Sure. Miles, all of my clients are either CEOs or the head of sales and marketing, or sales or marketing, for SaaS companies, typically in the 10 million to 100 million revenue range. And so that's who I am hoping will have access to the podcast and spend a little time listening to it, because the world of B2B marketing is moving so fast now, it's very difficult to keep up with. And that's why I and my team get hired to go in and straighten out the kinks in the rope that have developed over a number of years.
Yeah, and I'm curious, when you say it's kind of speeding up, how do you feel like it's changed in terms of the speed at which you need to move from when you started to today?
Many reasons. One of the top ones is the proliferation of media channels. You know, it used to be back in the day, there were three television channels and a handful of, you know, business magazines. And today we're adding channels and resources as fast as humanly possible. So we have to keep up with which channels are reaching which prospects. That's one thing. And then also the buyer's journey itself has changed tremendously in the last 2 years. It's very difficult to get a hold of a decision maker now. It's almost impossible. So we have to be adept at practicing putting our messages in front of them in a way that they recognize themselves. That's about the only way anybody's going to respond to you. So those are two reasons. I'm happy to talk about more if you need them.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So you have on the one hand the proliferation of like social media channels. So you have, you know, TikTok, and I'm not an expert compared to you, but Instagram, all Facebook, all these different consumer platforms are even bleeding into B2B. But on the other hand, it does feel like the traditional channels like phone calling and email marketing are getting incredibly saturated. So I'm curious, when you go in to consult a company and you're looking at the spread, which I know it could be enough to fill a whiteboard of initiatives and channels they're trying to win on, is your first instinct normally to cut back and win on a few channels, or is it to try to win broadly and see what works? Like, is it totally situation dependent?
Well, what we do first is take a look at what's working for them and what's not. So what we have typically in a new client is they're spread over multiple channels. And if they have any idea of what they're getting from those channels, it's usually not the correct idea. And so what we want to do is take a look at all they're doing. And we do want to trim back on what's not delivering. But at the same time, we want to bring their content level up to, again, that place where a prospect can see himself or herself in that content and see that somebody is talking about their problem or their challenge intelligently, and that it might be worth a few minutes to chat with that particular person.
And as a marketer, this is an interesting question. Do you find that creative has more success talking about a problem or talking about an opportunity?
I find that creative has much more success talking about a particular problem. You know, there's only two reasons why a B2B purchaser purchases anything. It either saves time or it saves money, and that's it. So what's happening with, I will say, my clients in particular is, they want to save more time or they want to save more money. And we could go into the entire iceberg under the surface of the sea of what they're doing that compromises both their time and their resources.
Yeah, I remember that from when I was at EMC and similar data storage marketing. They often taught us that. They said there were three reasons. Like, you know, it either has to be able to make them more money, save them more money, or reduce their risk, which is very similar to what you're saying. And other than that, you know, it's all just shiny bells and whistles that don't have a lot of meaning. So I'm curious, when you're in a fast moving space and you're expected, I know, to really be like a ninja. I mean, you're coming into companies without a lot of context and kind of expected to shock and awe people with insights and the ability to quickly move the needle. And you've proven over your career you can do that. How does someone with that much pressure on them learn? Like, how do you continually sharpen your saw?
Mm-hmm. Well, I learned a long time ago, Miles, and I'm a little bit older than you, for instance. But I learned that feeling intense pressure is not a good way to go to work. And so I learned ways to not feel that kind of pressure, even if the client is feeling pressure. But the things that we do, the way that we go about our work, really gets rid of the pressure. We use systems and methodologies for almost everything we do. So like take creating content, for example. We have a whole system that walks through many, many points and helps us derive from the client what is special about that client and their solution, even if they don't know it yet. So systems and methodologies are always a big help in my view.
And I'm curious, maybe as someone who feels client pressure, what would be one or two of those tips that really helped you learn to deal with it, if you don't mind sharing?
Sure. First of all, leave your work at home when at the end of the day. And of course, when I was a young guy, I had young kids and I had a wife at home, and you know, they needed my full attention when I got there. So that was one way. And then another way is to stay very active. I mean, I love sports. I still play sports today, and get a lot of exercise. I have a dog that needs walking all the time. So, and I spend a lot of time outdoors. So it really is balancing the yin and the yang in your life.
Yeah, it's a great point. I don't think we think enough about holistic well-being, even though it's being talked about more, versus performance, and realizing that performance at the expense of well-being isn't sustainable, even if it is better in the short term from a performance perspective. So I appreciate you touching on that. And I know you're a very, very competitive pickleball player. I don't know, a little off topic, but get to know your host question. Maybe you could share a little bit about that.
Well, I started playing a year and a half ago and just fell in love with it. Pickleball is a game that's played on a tennis court, but we only use half the court, and we have four players on that half of the court and two players on one side of the pickleball net and two players on the other side of the pickleball net. And pickleball is played with a hard paddle and a hard plastic ball. And so a little bit similar to tennis, a little bit similar to ping pong, a little bit similar to racquetball, all kind of rolled up into one. Very fun, very fast game, and it's a great workout.
Yeah, I've enjoyed playing it myself. It's a lot of fun, and it's cool that you're at the competitive level. So another question I had for you is, I know you've spent time in a lot of different parts of the country. On the West Coast, you currently live in Nashville, which is, you know, booming for healthcare and technology. I think some would say, you know, maybe the fastest growing city in the country. How much does it matter if you want to win in the SaaS space today to be in one of these high growth areas versus, you know, being somewhere like Iowa or where I live in Connecticut, where you're kind of off the beaten path?
Well, if you're off the beaten path, Miles, there's lots of workarounds, but there's a huge advantage to being in a well-disciplined technology community. Because your social events, the business events that you attend, I mean, they're populated by some really smart people. And, you know, the next wave of wealth creation is just an idea away. And, you know, I'm always constantly surprised at how many great ideas I have just from being around other smart tech people in person.
Yeah, I am as well. I mean, being in Boston, like I mentioned today, you can feel the buzz of even the big companies and the logos and the conferences you're seeing. There's just energy that you don't get when you're off to the fray, even though there might be some other benefits. So another question I had for you is, what's the role of failure in marketing success? I feel like we glorify this in the marketing space, and I'm curious, is it over-glorified, or is it really as important as people say?
There's a lot to unpack in that question, Miles, but I will say that the volume of content, like so take LinkedIn posts, for instance, on failing has increased astronomically. And what we don't want to see is an atmosphere created for reckless failing. And I wish that some of the authors of these videos and these podcasts and these articles would make a distinction between types of failing. So you can fail because you're lazy. You can fail because you're reckless. You can fail for a lot of different reasons that you have control over. I think what they are talking about is that if you give it your very best and you fail, then get up and start again, right? Because look at athletes. You know, professional athletes, they consider failure as nothing. It's just a ticket to entry. It's an admission to the game, and they fail over and over and over and over. Anybody training for a sport knows you're going to fail before you get good at it.
Yeah, I love how you mentioned that. It just feels like it has to be intelligent failure, because there's a difference between failing and getting better and failing carelessly. And not recognizing that if you're not getting better, you're not necessarily closer to success. It's just about realizing that the getting better is really the best sign of future success versus whether you're succeeding today, which is a great distinction. So for you, when you look at companies, I'm so curious about this, in the software space, is venture funding a non-negotiable, like just impossible to win in any meaningful way in SaaS without outside money? Are you still seeing examples of people really bootstrapping successful software companies?
Well, I'm definitely seeing a lot of examples of non-venture funded companies succeeding. It depends on how you're using venture. Private equity is an alternative to venture funding, right? There's lots of PE funded. There's lots of friends and family funded out there. We typically don't work with a company until they have $10 million in revenue, but I'm constantly being asked by CEOs of tech startups, you know, how do I do this? How do I do that? So I have a lot of conversations throughout a given year with tech startups, and the problems are always the same. Very common set of problems, and I'm always happy to share, what I can share over the phone for no charge.
Yeah, it's very generous. Now, what role do you mention kind of being a mentor to some of these up and comers? What role have mentors played in your own marketing success?
Mentors have played a large role. So I remember my very first job out of MBA school, and my boss was a young guy who had been recruited from Procter & Gamble to come to the company I was with. And the first thing he taught me was, back in the day we used memos, but it's the same rule. First thing he taught me was, whatever you want from me, put it in a recommendation and make it no more than a paragraph. Well, you know, that really starts a person on the road to true business discipline. And then another thing I learned along the way was, you know, how to frame my own thinking about a business situation that I was looking at. And to this day, I use the same 5 points that I used 30 years ago. And those 5 points are: what are the trends in this industry? What's driving those trends? What are my competitors doing about the trends? What am I doing about the trends? And then the last one is, what should we be doing about these trends to increase revenue and profitability?
It's fascinating. So trends are timing, I guess is another way to say it, is a huge part of success, is what you'd be saying.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think smart people in tech know that the greatest wealth creation is when you can place a solution that people will pay for on top of a coming wave of change. And it's a powerful, powerful visualization for tasks like product market fit. You know, is this product really different? Is this solution positioned at the top of a wave of change that's going to break on the shore?
And I want to double click on one thing you just mentioned, is the product really unique? I feel like in what I do, not a consultant, but just as an executor, I'm constantly seeing people who would kind of scream until they're blue in the face that what they're doing in IT marketing is so unique. Yet, at least as an outsider, I don't necessarily always see the difference in really in the, you know, value or the price that they're bringing to market. Is that your experience as well? Do you feel like people are kidding themselves about how unique they are in at least, you know, a fair number of cases?
Oh, yeah. I see it all the time. And I think the biggest change in my world in the last 5 to 10 years is that virtually every solution out there is now a commodity. And it's differentiated above the product level, not at the product level. I mean, when you differentiate at the product level, again, that's just ticket to entry. That really can't be sold anymore. So now we differentiate based on the company story, the authenticity of the people working in sales and marketing and on the executive team. It's the whole corporate spirit. And if a prospect can detect that corporate spirit is all about their particular challenge and helping them solve that challenge in a helpful way, in a way that doesn't create tons and tons and tons of more work for the client, then that particular solution is going to rise to the top of the pack.
And it's such an interesting point, like you mentioned, because there's multiple ways to win. Like I look at Airbnb, I think they're a brand that's done a great job of whenever there's a crisis, they're at the forefront of donating housing with their product in a way that gets a lot of positive PR and goodwill. Yet you have other brands that might do something dumb and they can lose our business, even though they might have the exact same product, but they can lose the majority of people's business because they disagree with the values behind maybe what that decision would suggest. And it's interesting you mention how each brand, you need an expert like you to come in and look at the 6 or 7 ways it could be framed to help figure out what's really the smoking gun one or two ways. Because every story is different. Because some companies have a great story that they can win on, others don't, and they should win on, like you said, service level or partnerships. Or so it's interesting how you see it. That's a cool way to think mm-hmm. about it.
Well, remember, I coupled the story with the integrity of the executive team. So let's take a fairly recent example. Let's look at Rework. Rework had an amazing story, and they hit all the hot buttons on social marketing. But they had a management team that was, I won't say they were corrupt, but when all the due diligence started on WeWork, it was found out that the company was doing things that were certainly not in the best interest of the shareholders. And as it turned out, were not in the best interest of the employees, all the employees who got laid off. When that whole house of cards crumbled. But if we take it back even to a deeper level, you know, you look at WeWork's business model. WeWork positioned themselves as some kind of a technology company. But when I first became aware of WeWork, the first thing that went through my mind is there a worse business model than this? I mean, they're selling, you know, little rental offices to very low capitalized entrepreneurs, you know, single, like solopreneurs and all that. I said, you know, the first thing that happens with an economic, the first thing that's going to happen when an economic downturn hits is their revenue stream is going to dry up very, very quickly. Well, lo and behold, COVID-19 came around and, you know, everybody vanished back into their homes and apartments. So I know WeWork is still in business. They got a huge capital infusion from SoftBank, which was one of their original investors. So they're still operating, but they certainly are not the media darling that they were back in the day.
Yeah, it's so interesting understanding how, to your point, discounting and who you're targeting also need to be really considered. Because so many startups, it seems like rush to get to $10 million, the size that you normally start to get involved. But it's, I almost think about it like dirty revenue. It's not profitable the way it's been raised. And you notice you can't do what you did at the $100 million level. That sounds like kind of first pinnacle story in your career success. You can't get that high without really solid fundamentals.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And you bring up a great point. Let's look at what's going on in the world of capital now, especially Silicon Valley capital. So for quite some time, for a period of, I want to say 3-4 years, company valuations, especially startup companies, were based on the number of users for that software. And then over the 3 or 4 years, investors discovered that number of users certainly is not directly correlated to the amount of revenue. And so the whole investment model in technology anyway has recently returned to the fundamentals, which I find pretty fascinating. So, you know, these fads come and go all the time. They come and go with technology solutions. They come and go with marketing. They come and go with sales and all that. But I will tell you that any company, whether you're a small company or a great big company, your best offense and defense is fundamentals.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. It's that the strategies don't change. The tactics might change, but the principles, those fundamental principles don't change. So I'm curious, last kind of big industry question, because you're in tech, I know you know a lot about IT marketing. What trends do you see dominating the next 3 to 5 years in that big iron data center world, cloud world that you and I both came from?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's take a look at what cloud has enabled. So what we see, entire economies now moving toward a global platform economy. Okay, so more and more B2B buyers, B2B purchasers are going to be looking at the ability to participate in global platforms. And of course, you know, anything that can be termed as a global platform is going to save time and money, especially in just communications, for instance. So that's one of the biggest trends that I see. And, you know, I'm also reading a book right now called The Shield of Achilles. And the author is a brilliant guy. And what he's doing with this book is explaining how, in terms of the global nations, how we are moving from nation states to market states. And his theory is fascinating. I'm halfway through the book now because I'm a marketing guy. Anytime you say market, you know, I'm going to perk up. But he does a very, very deep dive early in the book on how nation states, you know, like Italy and France and the United States, et cetera, came about in the first place. What were the conditions that caused the rise of these protected territories called nation states? And now he's moving into why those boundaries are slowly becoming less important. And now economies are going to start revolving around markets. So like the technology market, for instance.
Yeah, it's such an interesting thought, because if one thing's true in history, it does change. So just because it's the same way today, whether even with nations, it doesn't mean it'll always be. So another question I have for you as we kind of move towards the end is, if there's a young person that wants to get into the software industry, what would your advice be?
That's a great question, Miles. My advice would be to first decide whether you are a startup type of a person or a big company type of a person. If you go to a big company, you're going to learn a lot in a hurry, but you're going to pay a price with the bureaucracy and the, you know, just the, you know, the overall frustrating nature of large entities, right? If you go to work for a startup, you're going to learn to think on your feet. You're going to learn how to do many, many things, but you won't have the discipline that comes from working in a large company, at least for a couple of years. So that's the first thing I would advise anybody. And the second thing is, don't fake it. If you are not interested in technology, if you are not learning about the software, if you're not capable of understanding data storage and buffering and all these terms that are important to software, then don't come into tech, because you'll fail pretty quick and be shown the door.
Yeah, it's an interesting distinction as someone who's worked at both a Fortune 50 company and a startup of one person to know what you mean. I think the sooner you can know yourself, because there's glory in both sides, depending on the opinion. And you kind of got to know what you're suited for. Now, do you miss the big companies? I mean, just now being as more of a, you know, consultant and running a smaller, lean team, do you miss working with, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people?
Well, there's some aspects of it that I do miss. So when I was with Philips and a couple of other roles outside of Philips, I worked around the world, and I got to meet so many fascinating people from diverse cultures and made lots of good friends in lots of different countries. And that was great. That suited me for the age and space that I was in at that time. I'm a little older now. And, you know, getting on a plane and flying to Japan is more of a daunting task than it used to be. And I'm so grateful that communications have come as far as they have, where we have tools like Riverside, which is what we're using here, or Zoom, or, you know, Google, or what have you, because it really does cut down on the wear and tear of travel. So yes, I miss aspects of working in a big company. But like I said, our clients are generally in the $10 million to $100 million range. And for whatever reason, that's where my mind has settled as a suitable place for me to work.
Yeah, kind of a balance of some establishment and, you know, structure. You can't get to probably $50 million without some structure. But also that leanness of there's still a big vision for the future, whereas when you get to so big, you're kind of more defending than building. Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm curious, if anyone wants to reach out to you, either about SaaS Marketing Mastery or about Harris CMO, your company, for services, or just general life advice, or last but not least, if they're a pickleball player, what would be the best way to reach you?
Well, you can do a search on Mike Harris Marketing. That'll pull up my website very quickly. And the name of the company, again, is Harris CMO, Chief Marketing Officer Partners. And that will pull up the website at the top. And there are plenty of options for getting in touch with me through that website.
Perfect. Well, it's been a real privilege today. I can't wait to listen to some more episodes of the show. And certainly just appreciate your relationship to me and how much you've taught me. So I'm excited for you to do the same for all the other listeners.
Yes, I'm very glad that we met Miles. And I'll add for the audience that I met Miles through a client CEO who already knew Miles and recommended him. And, that's the way the business world turns, people.
Yeah, it's small world, absolutely. Well, thanks again. We'll look forward to hearing the next episode.
Thanks again for listening to SaaS Marketing Mastery. Feel free to check out more of Mike's content on LinkedIn. And if you'd like to be considered as a guest, please reach out to Mike. Thanks.